The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
The average age life expectancy in the UK is 81 for men. And in prisons, it's 57.
Wow.
And that's a whole host of reasons behind that. You know, complex and challenging lives, often issues with substance misuse. The fact that a prisoner kills themselves every 3.5 days, I think, is pretty shocking in 2025. You know, you are 10 times more likely to take your own life than the background population if you're a prisoner. Those kind of facts need to be in the discussion around what is prison for and who should be there.
The Hearing.
My name is Adrian Usher, and I'm the Prison and Probation Ombudsman for England and Wales, which means I investigate complaints from prisoners who have exhausted the prison complaint system, and I also investigate all deaths that occur in prisons in England and Wales.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Hearing. I am your host, Becky Annison. As lawyers, I think we feel a kinship with words like justice and phrases such as rule of law, even if we do not practice in areas such as criminal or constitutional law. In the UK, all solicitors have a duty to the court, even if they never set foot in one once our training is done, and that is certainly true of me. I have recently been reading articles in the press about the court's backlog and the prison overcrowding issues, and that has left me considering what justice means in a system that I am a part of with my duty to the court, but I really have nothing to do with, save as an ordinary citizen. My guest today is going to help me explore this topic.
The Hearing.
Hello. Thank you so much for coming to speak to me today. And it's a topic that I've definitely been reading some articles about, but I really want to know more than I'm seeing in the articles. And I think that you might be the person to help me with that. I would like to talk to you about the court backlog, I suppose. I'd like to explain what exactly is going on, because I'm sure what I'm seeing in the newspapers about the backlog in the courts is a fraction of the story. And in particular, how is that backlog in the courts affecting the prison service? And by extension, how is that affecting individuals?
Well, thank you very much for talking to me, Becky. I'm delighted to be here. And in my role as the Prison and Probation Ombudsman, the court backlog I'm kind of tangentially connected to, because it is the effect that backlog has on prisons that really I'm interested in and affects our work at the PPO. So the court backlog has been steadily rising. The causes of it, I believe, are much discussed, and I wouldn't propose that I'm an expert on that, but obviously COVID had a big effect. And essentially that backlog has doubled in the last 5 years. And is up to around, I think, in the mid 70,000s of cases that are awaiting trial. And I know from a story I was reading relatively recently that, you know, some low level offences that are being scheduled in the Crown Court are being scheduled for 2028, and that's an enormous amount of time for the accused to carry that burden, but also for the victims and to get some sense of justice. So it is, I think, a significant problem. As I say, COVID is one issue. There's issues around budgets and the desirability of being a defence solicitor and barrister these days. But the effect of that is that a proportion of those cases have the individuals are remanded in prison, that a magistrate or judge has decided that they pose a significant risk, either of flight or harm to the community. And so they are sitting in jails awaiting trial. And we know that we've got about 13,000 of those on remand. And that is a significant increase that we've seen over this last 5 years. And that's clogging up the justice system as a whole, but it's also clogging up prisons. And that has an effect on the whole prison estate.
Interesting. So we've touched a little bit on how the backlog came about, and we don't need to go into more detail on that unless there's something you feel you missed. But I kind of, as a lawyer, I suppose, I'm really curious about what this means for justice. Do you think, particularly with those 13,000 individuals on remand?
I actually think it's higher than that. I think it's 13,000 are in prison on recall, which is another topic of which I actually feel very strongly about. But I think it's about 18,000-19,000 are there on remand or awaiting sentence. So yes, that is, it's a higher number than I said.
Well, in that case, do you mind then if you could just quickly explain for me and the listeners, what is the difference between being on remand and being on recall?
So remand, the majority of prisoners who are in prison on remand have elected trial and have elected to go not guilty, and they are awaiting a trial. Some prisoners have had a trial and have been found guilty and are awaiting a sentence. Recall is a really important issue that isn't often discussed. And I can take a little bit of time to expand on that, because 13,000 prisoners are in prison because they have been at some stage released into the community and then adjudged by the probation service to that the only way their risk can be managed is to take them back into the prison estate. Now, when I was a young constable, when I joined the Met in 1987, in the late 80s and 90s, when I worked on a crime squad, in order for somebody to be recalled back into prison, the probation service needed to make an application to a magistrate, and that magistrate would determine whether there was sufficient risk. And we used to beg the probation service. There were individuals who we thought were committing lots of burglaries, and the probation service quite rightly said, look, the bar is very high before we approach a magistrate. So then in 1997, the law changed, and effectively it changed so that the probation service could make that decision on their own. So what is the net effect of that? Prior to 1997, there were around 200 prisoners in the system on recall, and now there are 13,000. And some of those prisoners, quite rightly, if they're posing a significant risk to the community, are recalled. Recall is, I think, a necessary mechanism. But there is a massive difference between 200 and 13,000. And I would ask the question, have we got that balance right? And some of the evidence I submitted to the independent review on sentencing being conducted by David Gork was addressing that point. And I hope that it's given due consideration from people with, much like yourself, Becky, with greater legal qualifications than mine. But I do just ask the question. So that's the difference between recall and remand.
That's very interesting, because I know that I did read a case, an article about a case where I think it was a 70 or 80 year old climate protester, a woman who they couldn't get a tag to fit her because she was so slender, and she couldn't wear one on her ankle because she had an existing health problem, DVT, I think. And because they couldn't find one to fit her wrist, they recalled her to prison, which probably doesn't feel like the sort of person who's out there committing tens of thousands of burglaries. But
absolutely, and I think there's an awful lot of people. Look, the probation service is well known. I have to be under some strain. I've got a great deal of sympathy with probation officers trying to manage a whole host of risks. But I do feel, you know, they wouldn't be human if you've got 50, 60 cases on your books and, you know, some of them are challenging and problematic, that, you know, recall must be a temptation all the time. And like I say, we really just need, I think, to ask the question, what's the correct balance there? Because if you take out some of that 13,000 out of the prison population, that's really significant in terms of a yield of being able to free up some space in a system that is under a great deal of pressure.
Absolutely. After that very interesting detour, thank you, I'm going to go back to my other question, which is, given the position we're in, with all of these additional people, I suppose, sitting in prison, waiting for a trial date, waiting for a sentencing hearing. What do you think this means for justice? I know that's a really big question, but do you think the ability for an individual, either a victim or someone who's been accused of a crime, do you think their ability to access justice is being affected?
I think there's probably sort of three different ways that I would look at that. Firstly, from the point of view of the victim, you know, if justice is going to be served, it needs to be swift. And in many cases, victims are not getting the response, the service that they should be getting from the criminal justice system. And in many cases, may lose motivation to give evidence. Their lives may change. They may want to just put it behind them, which means in some cases, they'll withdraw from the criminal justice process and then nobody gets justice. I think from the second way of looking at it is from the individual prisoner's point of view. And they are innocent and incarcerated. And that's a risk for society. And it's a risk that sometimes we deem is the right one. But in some individual cases, I've talked to prisoners who have been awaiting trial 3 years. And they say to me that they've been advised by their solicitor to change their plea, because they are never going to be sentenced to longer than they've already served. So many of them are changing their plea to guilty, because essentially it means as soon as they get a court date, they're released. The worry there is, of course, a proportion of those may be innocent, and they may be doing it as a matter of convenience and being pragmatic rather than fighting their cause in the court and risk getting potentially a longer sentence or waiting longer. And I think that's, you know, those numbers won't be very high, but however many there are, that is not right and that is not justice. And then I think the third way that this should be viewed is through the lens of the whole prison system, because that pressure on numbers, I investigate every death that occurs in a prison in England and Wales. And sadly, around 100 individuals take their own lives in the prison environment every year. And we've seen that number go up. It's gone up by about 15% over the last 3 or 4 years. We're seeing a steady rise of individuals dying in prison in general. But that self-harm and self-inflicted death figures tell us that there may be something going on, and it may be connected to overcrowding. What happens in prisons, which we saw before the SDS 40 releases that occurred earlier this year, when roughly 5,000 prisoners were released when the rules changed on when they could be released early. But prior to that, prisons were absolutely full. And when a prison becomes full, the net effect is it slowly grinds to a halt. It's harder and harder for the dedicated staff that work in prisons to be able to deliver the regime. And when I say the regime, what I mean is prisoners being let out of their cells to go to education, to go to work or other meaningful activity. And just the sheer volume of people in means that that becomes increasingly difficult to do. And often the decision is made that it's impossible to do and on any given day. And that means prisoners are behind the doors for 23 hours or more every day. Now, if that's happening to you 3, 4, 5 times a week, the effect on your mental health, I think, is significant. And is that behind the rise in self-inflicted deaths that we've seen? It's a possibility. And the prison service did gain some space with that early release scheme, but they're filling up again. You know, they're very rapidly, they're going to be under the same kind of pressure. So from our perspective, we look at this very much through the lens of, are prisoners harming themselves because the sheer strain on their mental health by regimes not running because the prison is too full? And what can we do about that? And as I say, if you take out that 17,000-18,000 who are awaiting trial, and you take out 13,000 who have been recalled to prison, that's, you know, about 40% of the prison population at a stroke. Now, you can't wave a magic wand and deliver that, but it does show, you know, what might be possible with some changes in thinking and changes in practice.
I've got another question, sort of leading on from that discussion. It was really interesting to me to hear about how the rules had changed on recall and how that had led to going from 200 people to 13,000. What are the sort of thresholds for the remand? Has that changed? Has there been a similar explosion in the remand population?
I think remand has, certainly the backlog of cases has doubled in the last 5 years. So if it's a straight translatable metric, then you would expect remand to have gone up significantly. So, I'd be very surprised if it hasn't, you know, if that trend hasn't followed the backlog. In some ways it's surprising, because if you look at what's happened to arrest figures since 2000, they've nearly halved. So that the last couple of years they've gone up, I think, a few percent, but broadly the trend has been far, far fewer people being arrested for a variety of reasons. So how has that reduction not translated into a reduction in court backlogs? As we talked about earlier, I think you can talk about COVID, you can talk about budgets and paying conditions and all sorts of things that I'm in no way an expert on. And there's also probably something about the complexity of cases we have, I think, seen a significant rise over the last few years in complex, historic sexual offence cases, which have had two effects. One is they take up a significant amount of court time, but secondly, they're part of the reason why we're seeing the prison population getting older. Part of the reason we're seeing more deaths in prison is, frankly, because there's an awful lot of natural cause deaths in prison. And with an aging population, that's almost what you'd expect to see. I think it's worth just dropping in, possibly you, to think about that the average age life expectancy is in the UK is 81 for men, and then in prisons it's 57.
Wow.
And there's a whole host of reasons behind that, you know, complex and challenging lives, often issues with substance misuse and drug and alcohol misuse. But it is something that it's one of the reasons when I left the police, having been reached a relatively senior rank, that I came into this work in the first place. It's the fact that a prisoner kills themselves every 3.5 days, I think, is pretty shocking in 2025. You are 10 times more likely to take your own life than the background population if you're a prisoner. Again, lots of complicated reasons behind that, but also the effect on your health of being incarcerated is very significant. Those kind of facts need to be in the discussion around what is prison for and who should be there. Unquestionably, there's some very dangerous people who society needs to be protected from. But we do need to consider all of the effects on an individual of being in prison, and certainly health is one of them.
That's really interesting. So my next question, which is in a similar space, I suppose, talking about the impact on individuals. If somebody does change their plea because they've effectively served so long on remand that were they to change their plea, the next time they get a court date, that they would be freed. And frankly, as a pragmatist myself, if I've already spent 3 years in prison, the prospect of spending another 3 years potentially, or getting home in a couple of weeks, is, you know, I think I would take that. I think I would absolutely take that. I think I would feel like that would be, you know, I would find it hard, I think, to dig within myself and say, no, on a matter of principle, I'm going to go to prison. I'm going to stay in prison for an unknown period of time to prove my innocence. If people do take that option, what's the impact on those individuals afterwards? Because now they have although they have already been in prison and that wouldn't have changed, they have a conviction on their record now, which they wouldn't have had before. What do you think for those individuals, the impact on their future life is from making that decision?
Of course, it has all sorts of effects depending on the offence and how serious it is on future employment chances, on, you know, in some cases, those offences have to be declared depending on what they are to get certain jobs or be considered for certain jobs. You know, the whole experience of being in prison at all has a very significant effect on people's lives, because they certainly will lose their job. They may well lose their home, and some of them then live under the threat of recall. So those people that we're talking about, and as I said earlier, I think that those numbers, I would hope, would be very low, but even so, it's a concern. But if you're one of those people, yes, you may have been released because essentially you've done time served, but you might be released on license, which means you're living constantly with the threat of being recalled. And that, again, for your mental health is not optimal. Not knowing every day when you get up, am I going to be coming back to this bedroom this evening, or is it going to be a prison cell? Depending on, you know, to an extent, my behavior, which is something I can control and should be responsible for, but sometimes from factors beyond my control, who am I associating with? What, you know, have I missed a probation appointment or two? And as I travel around prisons around the country, I listen to an awful lot of prisoners. And look, I'm not naive. I'm hearing, you know, in some cases from people who are exceptionally manipulative and, you know, very good at being dishonest. But I consistently hear stories of I've been recalled because I was late for two probation appointments. I've been recalled because I missed a probation appointment or two. Like I say, I take an awful lot of that with a pinch of salt, and there are some checks and balances within the system to try and address those. But an awful lot of people who are recalled are released relatively promptly when their cases are reviewed independently. So, that was a very long way of saying that I think the effect on those, that if anybody changes their plea to guilty when they have not committed the offence, that feels fairly tragic to me.
So presumably you may also have individuals who are innocent, who have served 3 years, they've taken the deal, if you like, to just to get home, get back to their family. But then now they're in the probation system, and probation itself is a still a form of a block on liberty. Presumably you can't just decide you're going to go on holiday next week. And
there will be a proportion that, as I say, will be, if they go guilty and that part of their sentence may be a probationary period, they may just get time served and be able to walk away, albeit with the blemish of a criminal conviction. But there will be a proportion that are released on license, and that is definitely a curb on your liberty and the standard by which you're expected to live your life, and feed back to the probation service how you are living your life. Of course, some people live with that burden their whole lives if they're released on life license. And those individuals who are released under the IPP sentencing, I think that there are very, very few people who don't recognise that IPP was a significant mistake in terms of a sentencing option. And we shouldn't forget that there are still 3,000 people in prison, the vast majority significantly over their original tariff, who were sentenced to IPP in the 2000s and early 2010s. So, and when they come out, they very often are recalled, and they live... there have been some changes, both in the last government and this government has made some progress, I think, in clarifying the rules on IPP, changing some of the requirements to be sort of free of the license. And those numbers have come down, but there's still an awful lot of men, and it's the vast majority are men, are still in the system.
The hearing. On the outside, you're a lawyer. Calm and cool, but inside there's a passion to perform. A drive to be absolutely on your game.
You prepare hour after hour, day after day in the pursuit of excellence, relying on superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. That's the advantage we give you. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes, every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
I wanted to ask you next. There's a lot of lawyers in the world who have nothing to do with the criminal justice system. People like me, I'm a contracts lawyer. And yet, as lawyers, we are part of the same community. We're still in community with people who work in the criminal justice system, with the lawyers who do. Every lawyer, certainly when I was training to be a lawyer, every lawyer had to do a compulsory criminal justice module to qualify. I think that's right. I certainly remember doing mine. And so we have this kind of strange system where we have a lot of people who have a little bit of knowledge and a professional kinship with people who work in a very, very different place and a very, very different space to them. But yet we're all kind of, I suppose, bonded together by words like justice and the rule of law and things like that. What is something that you wish the lawyers like me, who have a relationship with justice as lawyers professionally, but who don't work with courts, who don't work with the probation service, who aren't part of the criminal justice system, what is something you wish we understood about the current situation that probably isn't really being reflected in the press right now?
I think, as I say, the effects, the true effects of actually being in prison, it is a significantly has a significant negative impact on your health and a variety of other effects upon you that I think most members of the public and lawyers don't think about when they think about, you know, very often the only time that a prisoner's sentence is mentioned at the point of conviction in the press. And that means, of course, you're seeing it right next to the offence and the emotional effect that has on you. But very often people don't then think about, and I think this is particularly the case, Becky, with short sentences. One of the things that I've absolutely changed my mind on after, you know, 35 years as a police officer in London, coming into this role and spending an awful lot of time in prisons, I would like lawyers and others to really think hard about innovative ways that our alternatives to sentences that are for fewer than 2 years, because those sentences are fantastic. You know, the revolving door prisoners that often are sentenced to, you know, 6 months, a year, 18 months, fewer than 2 years, you suffer all of the negative effects. So you lose your job, you lose your home, you may well lose supportive relationships. And that is, in a way, almost more damaging than any period of time you're spending incarcerated. And there are alternatives, and I don't claim to have a silver bullet on this, but I think everybody engaged in the criminal justice system, and whether that's the police, lawyers, judges, prison staff, have a responsibility to build public confidence in the system as a whole. And those short-term sentences, I don't think, do anything to build public confidence. That I don't think the public feel any safer for them. And that there are lots of smart people involved in the law. I mean, let's be honest, you have to be fairly smart to even, you know, embark on a career in the law. And there's lots of lawyers who are very bright, innovative people who I think should be involved in the conversation about, look, what are the other ways to go on this? So there is the independent review currently, and I'm sure that lawyers can find all kinds of ways to try and engage with that and have engaged with that. But going forward is just, I think it would be a tremendous boon for society if we thought of different ways of protecting society but also giving individuals the best possible chance of making better choices in their lives. And that for me is not spending a relatively short amount of time in prison.
Now, that's really interesting. And that's not something, as somebody outside the system, that I would have thought at all. I would have thought, well, 6 months, I suppose it's over quick. What you're saying is the worst effects are going to be disproportionate if you're only spending 6 months than if you're spending 10 years. So that's very interesting.
Well, so one of the things we do at the Ombudsman's Office is we investigate deaths post-release. If you die within 2 weeks of being released. And we did a bit of a thematic review of that data a couple of months ago. And one of the things that that revealed was that the huge impact of being released homeless. So about 14% of prisoners are released homeless in general. But of those who die within 2 weeks, about 35% of them are homeless. So it is a significant factor. One of the things I was enormously impressed that the prison service and probation and health and all the other people involved in this, when SDS 40 came along and they released 5,000 in largely in two batches, a huge amount of work was done to ensure that all of the kind of supportive rules that are in place to assist offenders being released were followed. Because, you know, let's be honest, because they were going to be under a lot of media scrutiny for this. So I think everybody really pulled together on that. For, as I say, the prison service itself, probation, health, local authorities. I was bracing myself and, in fact, had moved some, you know, human resource around, believing this is a straightforward metric. We've released, oh, we're going to release 5,000 more people. There will be more deaths within the first 2 weeks. To the best of our knowledge, none of those individuals died within the first 2 weeks. And I think, you know, the numbers, my research team will be shouting at me that the numbers aren't big enough to be statistically significant. But I think that's a really interesting fact, that when those services like housing, substance misuse, alcohol misuse, when they're all engaged, actually, there are some, you know, those rules are in place for a reason. There are some wins here that can be achieved. And I think everybody involved in criminal justice, lawyers, members of the public, everybody, I view the system through the lens of thinking nearly every prisoner that is sent to prison gets out. So let us start thinking about what do we want to happen when they get out. And what I want to happen is I want them to be the minimum risk to society, to my family, to the wider community. And minimizing that risk starts in prison. It starts by allowing prisoners to educate themselves, to engage with meaningful work and activity, perhaps learn a trade, consider their own offending, consider their own, the choices that they have made. There's some amazing programs in prison. I think of Grendon Community in particular.
Is that still going?
It is.
I was just going to say that when I was a law student at university, which must have been, oh crikey, 25 years ago, in my first year, we did a trip to HMP Grendon. And it's wonderful to hear it's still going.
It is. And listen, I know an awful lot of people believe that prison, an element of prison should be punishment. Well, believe me, I thought as a relatively tough ex-police officer, I go into prisons, you know, previously when I went into prisons, it was usually because a prisoner would ask to see me and I would sit in an interview room, have a chat and leave. The life on the landing is a very different experience. Some of those places are, frankly, terrifying, and I'm not sure how long I'd last in them. But when I went to Grendon and met the prisoners there, they are engaged in 3 hours of group work every day where they are forced in some ways to confront what they've done and the reasons for what they've done. And other prisoners are on a tremendously harsh audience. And the one word that consistently was used by the prisoners that I spoke to there was brutal. It is brutal to face up to what you've done and to face up to it in front of people who will not let you get away with saying, my pet dog died when I was five, and I think that's the effect. They are absolutely on them to own what they've done. And I think it was a really, really interesting day that I spent there. So again, a very, very long way of saying that there are a variety of things that people think that prison is for. But as I say, for me, one of the most significant is what happens when they walk through the gate on the way out, and what can we do in prison to assist them to lead offence-free lives, reconnect with family and loved ones, reconnect with communities. And that's something that I don't think we've got right. The prisons, it's tremendously difficult to stay in contact with loved ones and families inside it. And again, people will say part of your punishment is being severed from those communities. Well, I just don't hold with that, really, because loss of liberty is not the same as isolation. And I've spoken and written articles many times on things like the issue of phone calls in prisons. Prisoners pay for phone calls per minute when almost nobody in society pays for phone calls per minute. They pay more for their phone calls. And a prisoner will earn, if they work morning and afternoon for 5 days a week, they might earn £20 a week. And at the end of that week, they've got a choice of, do I buy vapes? Do I buy additional food? And bear in mind that the budget for a prisoner's food is, I think, £3 a day. So they very often choose food. They often choose vapes. It takes a real strength of character to choose phone calls. And even then, if you're paying per minute, that doesn't go very far. Now, prisons and prison staff have come on leaps and bounds in providing adequate telephony to prisoners to be able to make that choice. But I think it would be far, far better if they had a really good look at the contract they have with telephony providers and absolutely ensured that prisoners have the best chance at reasonable rates of being able to stay in contact with their loved ones, stay in contact with their families. If they do, society benefits. You are 37% less likely to reoffend if you stay in contact with loved ones whilst you're incarcerated. So if you imagine taking 37% out of the overall cost of crime in this country, organizing a way of prisoners being able to stay in contact with family and friends through making telephony easier and visits easier to access, I think benefits everybody.
Going back to one of your earlier points, when the prison system is completely overcrowded and you have people in their cells for 23 hours a day, presumably then visits and phone calls also fall by the wayside.
They do, and there are prisons that just don't have the infrastructure to be able to facilitate the number of visits that a prisoner should have. I mean, I've even seen that monetized. So where prisoners can be tremendously innovative, where visiting an establishment that didn't have sufficient space, didn't have the right infrastructure to be able to provide the right number of visits, what happened was they released the visiting slots, and prisoners would book them via sort of app technology that was available on the wing. But they'd book as many as they possibly could. And then some of them, for payment, would release some of those whilst standing next to another prisoner who quickly booked it. Now, that's a fairly light-hearted anecdote of what's going on in prisons. But actually, if you dig behind it, it becomes pretty sad pretty quickly. People being forced to pay other prisoners in order to access their loved ones. And it makes, you know, those visits are used by families to stay in contact with their kids and stay in contact with people who absolutely maximize their chance of them not coming back to prison when they come out.
Interesting. I wanted to end on a lighter note, but unfortunately my last question is anything but. I wanted to ask you, Adrian, if we don't fix this, because it doesn't feel like it's fixed right now. And we've had a change of government and new people have been brought in, but it still feels like we are in a desperate situation with the backlog in the courts and a desperate situation with overcrowding in prisons. If this situation continues of overcrowding, of no access to courts, of prisoners changing their plea just so that they can get out on time served instead of accessing proper justice for themselves and or for the victims, what do you think are going to be the consequences? What's going to happen if this continues?
Well, let's start with the darker side of that question and see if we can end with something slightly more optimistic. Essentially, it can't continue. The prisons will fill up again, and eventually that means that irrespective of the backlog in courts, the system absolutely will grind to a halt. And, you know, the net effect last time was actually in real numbers, a relatively small number of prisoners were housed in police cells rather than the prison estate. But that has an impact on policing, and it has an impact on the number of people who can be arrested and processed and put through the criminal justice system. So it, in some ways, it can't carry on. So, but as I say, let's try and be positive. I think the independent review on sentencing is a real opportunity. As I say, a lot smarter legal minds than mine will be thinking of options that might address, for instance, recall. It might address short-term sentencing and have alternatives. To, you know, technology is moving all the time. Tags have come on for my day in policing, which I only retired 2 years ago, but they're now able to not just monitor where you are, but to prompt individuals, you know, it's time for your probation appointment, it's time for your curfew. It's so that, you know, the sorts of things that we don't consider at all with our mobile phones and, you know, ruling our lives. But these little things make a difference to prisoners who often lead chaotic lives. So I think that review is a potential for optimism. I think, look, I'm an independent body and I'm a long way from being political with a capital P. But I think the appointment of Lord Timpson and the fact that he has stated openly that he intends to be in post for the full 5 years, which other prisons ministers have not always had that opportunity. You know, things happen in government, ministers move around.
He was a very interesting appointment. I remember when that was announced. That was an interesting appointment.
Well, he's certainly come with an enormous amount of energy. He has actually a great deal of experience. You know, 15% of people who work in Timpson's are ex-offenders, which I think sort of says that he practices what he preaches. So I think just having that stability for 5 years will allow some things to be tried, and some of them will work, and, you know, in the way of things, perhaps some of them won't. But having somebody consistently at the helm, I think, can only benefit the prison system. Somebody who comes in and, you know, perhaps needs less education on prisons and how they work is a positive. So I try and be optimistic. Look, my life is spent surrounded by death and complaints from prisoners, and we haven't touched on complaints, but complaints have gone up from people coming to the Ombudsman's office from prisons seeking justice, and I think that's almost certainly connected with overcrowding and you know, the system slowing down and coming close to stopping on occasions. But I think there are opportunities in the next few years for us to have a real think as a society about what is it that prison is for, and what do we hope to achieve, and what does it mean when they walk out of the gate?
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was very interesting from someone who has an interest in justice but doesn't really have anything to do with the system. That was incredibly interesting.
Well, I'm very grateful for the time. Thank you for talking to me.
The Hearing.
I found my conversation with Adrian both interesting and strangely motivating. Justice is an important concept to me as a lawyer. It does matter, even if day to day I deal in contracts rather than at the sharp end of loftier sounding concepts like the rule of law. It is a privilege in some ways that I don't have to look too closely at the messy business of justice in the same way as my criminal colleagues. I agree with Adrian that everyone, but perhaps especially those of us with a rarely used duty to the court, should stare in the face of what it really means for the state to deprive an individual of their freedoms, or for a victim to have to wait years for justice for lack of an available court date. And I will certainly be doing that over the next few months. Thank you so much to Adrian for chatting with me, and thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, then please do like and subscribe for more content. And if you want to comment on anything you've heard today, then email us at thehearing@thomsonreuters.com. I've been Becky Anderson. Goodbye.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.